From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Israelis cast ballots today for the second time in 5 months, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu looking for a fifth term. It's a parliamentary system, and back in May, Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party failed to form a government. The BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher is in Jerusalem. And Barbara, this election could be seen as a referendum on Netanyahu. He's making a hard appeal to right-wing voters. Last week, he said he would apply Israeli sovereignty in the Jordan Valley if he wins. That's on top of his past pledge to annex Jewish settlements in the West Bank. So what's the significance of those promises, and how are voters responding?
Well, the promises are significant in that they put annexation more firmly on the agenda rather than what has normally been the case, which is a negotiated two-state solution, a Palestinian state alongside an Israeli state. And the Palestinians and others, the UN, the Europeans, including some Jewish American groups in the international community, they all responded with alarm because they said this would be the death blow to any chance of an independent Palestinian state. In terms of the election here, Mr. Netanyahu's promise was meant to appeal to his far-right nationalist and settler base, and it could sway some votes there, but I think the general reaction in Israel was skepticism, actually. It was widely seen as an empty campaign promise, or also indifference, because many Israelis feel that the Palestinian track is hopeless and they've disengaged from it. It's not really an issue in the campaign. And Palestinians, too, actually don't see a big difference between Mr. Netanyahu's party and his main opposition. The opposition isn't talking about annexation, but it's not either talking about two states.
Well, you say, you know, this, the Palestinian question has sort of been sidelined, but last week Hamas fired rockets into Israel, which responded with tank fire. So how does that fit in the picture?
Yeah, it does fit in the picture because of the rocket fire. So Gaza in particular is part of the equation, especially because Mr. Netanyahu had to be rushed off the stage to safety during a campaign event in a community close to Gaza recently, Ashdod, because of this rocket fire. And there were images of that, and they went viral. So there was fierce criticism from his rivals because of his performance. They said he was abandoning his supporters, national humiliation, and so on. But also because of his policy. He has been accused of being too soft on Gaza, and it's his Achilles heel, really. So we have been getting reports that after the Ashdod incident, Mr. Netanyahu wanted to carry out a major military strike, but he was held back by the Attorney General, who said that he needed a security cabinet approval first. So It's hard to know what's posturing and what's real given this election campaign. But again, the main opposition party has been advocating a tougher action on Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza.
Well, and then talk about Netanyahu's main challenger, the centrist Blue and White Party led by former military chief Benny Gantz. What is his, you know, pitch to voters?
Yes, Benny Gantz, he was a big star in the army, but he hasn't really made much of an impact as a politician. He's sort of seen as kind of colorless, his main attribute being that he's not Mr. Netanyahu. In fact, I was speaking to one commentator who told me actually he is a bit more animated this round than last time, because before he thought he was doing Israelis a favor, and now he really wants to win. So we'll see. But anyway, his main pitch is that he can bridge the divisions in Israeli society and the divisions over sectoral politics and just represent the majority. He said that the choice in this election is between an extremist government, but that's because some of Mr. Netanyahu's supporters are very far right, and a secular broad unity government that represents 80% of the population, which he would bring about. And he talks about things like improving education and health in the poor areas and easing some of the religious rules imposed by the ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah. Now, we haven't even mentioned that Netanyahu is facing allegations of bribery and fraud in corruption cases. So where do those cases stand? And, you know, it seems like that's been going on for a while. Is that going to impact him in the election?
It has been going on for a while. He is facing possible charges in three cases of fraud and bribery, and the Attorney General has indicated that he's likely to be indicted, but he is going to give Mr. Netanyahu a hearing in early October to make his case. So that's where those things stand. In terms of the election, it's unlikely to affect votes from his base. Polls show they're not that bothered. It may motivate more votes from the opposition, in the sense that Mr. Netanyahu is accused of assaulting democratic institutions as he tries to defend himself. So things like trying to curb the judiciary and undermining the police by accusing them of witch hunt and so on. It will also make Mr. Netanyahu probably more vulnerable in coalition negotiations, because it's widely believed that he wants a new government to pass a law which would grant him immunity from prosecution. And in exchange for that sort of promise, coalition partners will make demands.
Well, of course, President Trump is a staunch ally of Netanyahu. He's thrown his weight behind him in this election. As Israelis go to the polls today, we'll see how that works out. Barbara, thank you. The BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher in a busy BBC studio in Jerusalem.
And we're broadcasting today from Arizona, where the state Supreme Court ruled Monday in favor of a business that refused to print wedding invitations for gay couples. The court said that the city of Phoenix's anti-discrimination ordinance could not be used to force the business owners to make the custom wedding announcements. Joanna Duca is co-owner of Brush and Nib Studios and a plaintiff in the case.
We're still obviously reading through the decision and figuring out all of the implications, but this is a victory, and it's covered our ability to speak freely as artists.
KJZZ senior field correspondent Brett Jaspers has been following all of this and several other political stories in Arizona, and he joins me now in the studio. Brett, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, last year, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a similar case when it ruled in favor of a baker in Colorado who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. That was a very narrow ruling. How does this case in Arizona compare?
Well, in two very important ways. One is the Alliance Defending Freedom. That is a Christian legal group that represents both the wedding invitation artists here and the Colorado baker.
Oh, the same one.
The same legal group, right. And they're also representing a florist in Washington State in another similar case. The second way there's some commonality here is that the conflict between artistic freedom and freedom of speech on the one hand is in contrast to the public need to prevent discrimination on the other. So if you remember, the Supreme Court last year ruled in the Baker case, but said that the baker wasn't treated right by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. You know, that's how they decided that. They didn't rule on this issue of, you know, free speech versus anti-discrimination. In the Arizona ruling that came out yesterday, the state court, it was narrow as well, but it did say that these particular wedding invitations are artistic expression. They did say the wedding invitation is speech. So that's a way that is slightly different from what the Supreme Court did.
Okay, so that just makes me wonder what this means for the anti-discrimination ordinance in Phoenix, which it was basically designed to protect LGBTQ people. And we see a lot of these types of laws and ordinances in other cities and states as well. How will this stand in Phoenix?
Well, the city said that the law still stands, and the majority justices in the decision said this ruling applies just to these wedding invitations and just at this business. So they tried to narrow it to just this particular instance at this particular business. I mean, the dissenting judges didn't quite buy that. They were skeptical. They kind of saw this as leading to discrimination in lots of other contexts. KJZZ just had a legal analyst on who said, you know, other companies would be able to use the rationale in the case against other ordinances like this in other Arizona cities. But, you know, because they use Arizona's constitution to make their decision, you know, it's pretty subscribed to Arizona.
I'm sure we'll be talking about this a lot more if this organization is handling cases throughout the country that are similar to this.
For sure.
This is one political story that you're following, but we have several others. We'll get to some of them. There is also a big Senate race in Arizona coming up in 2020. Former astronaut Mark Kelly looks to be the favorite to get the Democratic nomination, and he's running against Martha McSally, who holds John McCain's old seat. Could this race shift the balance in the Senate? That's the big question.
Sure. I mean, it's definitely one of the states that Democrats need to pick up in order to flip the Senate. So there's a lot of focus on it. Prognosticators call this race a toss-up. So yeah, I mean, if Democrats want to win the Senate, you know, Arizona is one of their number one targets.
We also know Kelly because he's the husband of former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who survived the assassination attempt in Tucson in 2011 that we all remember. He's well known in the state, but a newcomer to politics. You spoke with him and he brought up an interesting name. Let's listen.
When John McCain represented us, all of us here in Arizona in the United States Senate, you know, he had a campaign finance reform bill to get corporate money out of politics. He was a guy that represented, you know, Arizona as, you know, more of an independent, not beholden to a political party or, you know, any company out there. That's what we need to see.
Okay, so this is interesting because we know McCain was known as a maverick, but he's also a Republican. What do you think this says about state politics that a Democrat is reminiscing about the days of McCain?
Well, I think it says that Democrats view embracing McCain as smart politics, good for their election chances. Kyrsten Sinema is our other U.S. senator. She's a Democrat, won last year against McSally. She talks about McCain frequently did in her victory speech. And, you know, the far right and other voters that Martha McSally needs have a contentious and complicated and relationship with McCain. They don't necessarily like him. So, you know, embracing McCain puts Kelly in the center.
Yes. Okay, very quickly, our last question, 30 seconds. President Trump won Arizona by 4 points in 2016. It could be a battleground next year. Is Arizona really in play for Democrats?
Well, a couple of things. We talked about those swing voters, the Sinema voters who also voted for Governor Ducey. Those are possible voters for a Democratic nominee. There's also Latino voters who are growing statewide. It really will matter who the Democrats nominate, according to some strategists I've talked to.
Absolutely. Okay. KJZZ senior field correspondent Brett Jaspers. Brett, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
What happens when Ronald McDonald walks into a poor immigrant neighborhood in the south of France and sets off a supersized revolution? The story of how a company slogan to sell more shakes and burgers became a rallying cry for workers in France. That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
Some General Motors auto workers are back out on the picket lines today. It's day two of a nationwide strike of nearly 50,000 United Auto Workers from more than 50 GM plants across the country. GM and the UAW are back at the negotiating table as well. One of the biggest issues for striking workers is GM's tiered wage system, which allows some workers to earn more than others based on a number of factors. Let's talk more about this with Tracy Samilton, who covers the auto industry for member station Michigan Radio. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Can you explain for us this tiered wage system at GM? It dictates how much someone makes, what kind of benefits they receive, and so on.
Yeah, that's right. There was a little shade of it before 2007. You'd hire in at about $21 and really quickly work your way up to the top wage of about $28 in 3 years. But after 2007, if you were hired after 2007, that changed dramatically. So now you hire in at about $17 an hour, and it takes 8 years to work yourself up to the top wage, which is about $30, $31 an hour. Mm-hmm. And the benefits are different also. You used to be eligible for a pension upon retirement, and now it's a 401k retirement account. So it's a pretty dramatic difference.
Yeah, and temporary workers earn about $15 an hour with no vision or dental benefits.
Right? Yeah, and they don't have that contractually mandated way to sort of work themselves up to a specified higher wage.
Okay, this might be common in other industries like tech. We know that this is a system that's in that industry, but it's pretty new for GM. When and why? You mentioned that it was around 2007, but why the company implemented this system?
Well, it was in the contract that they did during the bankruptcy. So it sort of looked back to 2007, but this started in about 2009 when GM was in bankruptcy and everybody had to pitch in to keep this company from going out of business, including the rank and file. So to try to sort of get their labor costs in line with foreign automakers, they came up with this two-tier system to make the labor costs at GM much lower than they were before.
Yeah, as you were saying, everyone kind of decided to go in on this to save the company, including the union.
Yeah, they
did. What kind of dynamic has this system created, though, now among auto workers at these plants? What impact has it had on morale?
It hurts morale. It creates resentment, not just on the part of the lower paid workers. You know, it's a real culture shift here for the union where used to be we all do the same work for the same pay. And, you know, now you might be working alongside somebody who's a temp, who's having trouble paying their bills, or maybe it's your buddy who's getting the lower wage. And, you know, it just creates unhappiness amongst everybody to sort of know that differential is there.
Have you had a chance to speak with the UAW addressing and how they're addressing this tiered wage system in this negotiating process?
So the union is being pretty close about what's going on in the negotiations, but they are very well aware that the rank and file thought that this two-tier system was going to go away at some point. They really thought these concessions were temporary and that we're eventually going to get back what we gave GM to keep them out of bankruptcy. And now that now it's starting to look like those things were not temporary, they're permanent.
That they may be a permanent part of working for the company.
Yeah,
it's been reported that the GM CEO, Mary Barra, makes upwards of $21 million. That was last year. That's 295 times more than the average GM employee. Has that come up as a sticking point for any of the workers or union members that you've talked to?
I'm laughing because if you go on any Facebook page of any person who's on the picket line right now, that's like the number one meme on their Facebook page, how much Mary Barra is making compared to, you know, what the rank and file make. And it's really hurtful in a way because they know that Barra's compensation is tied to investor sentiment. And investors like a company that's lowering their labor costs. So her pay is not necessarily going to go down if their pay goes down. Mm-hmm. She may, in fact, be rewarded.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the morale. Folks right next to each other, working right next to each other, making vastly different salaries. What other things have employees told you about some of the things they want the union to bring to the table?
Well, they've read the same stories that the rest of us are reading, that GM's first offer may have been, we want you to pay not just a little more, but quite a bit more for your health insurance. Mm. And, you know, health insurance with only about a 4%, you know, sort of copay situation is almost the holy grail for people who work in the auto factories. They have really good insurance and they don't have to pay as much for it as, say, someone out there in working for another kind of corporation. So the average for somebody in the U.S. is paying maybe 28% of their overall health insurance costs. And like I said, for a union worker, it's about 4%, and they do not want that touched.
Yeah. Last we heard, the union and GM were very early in contract negotiations. They had gone through about 2% of some of the issues that they were dealing with. What have you heard so far since then?
Oh, about like how long will this take?
How long will this take? Yes.
So that is the crystal ball question. I ask everybody I interview that question, and I don't even think the negotiators know. So my guess, and I'm going to stick with this estimate, anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks. That's me.
Well, thank you so much. This is Tracy Samilton, reporter for Michigan Radio, talking with us about the ongoing GM auto worker strike. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
So, have you seen them? Swarms of dragonflies, so big they're showing up on weather radar. Last week, people in Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania had sightings. What's up with dragonflies? Aquatic insect expert Christine Goforth is on the case. She works at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, runs an online citizen science project called the Dragonfly Swarm Project. She also has a blog. So, Chris, this is a thing. Dragonfly swarms, what are they?
Yeah, so dragonfly swarms are big groups of dragonflies that are typically feeding on little prey insects. And so you can get anywhere from a dozen to millions to even billions of dragonflies flying together in these big groups.
Well, and is there anything going on, I mean, showing up on radar? We'll have pictures at herenow.org. Anything unusual about that?
It's not particularly unusual. This is the season of the year where the dragonflies are starting to migrate. So the migratory species are starting to move from the more northern parts of North America southward. And so you have a whole lot of dragonflies that are on the move right now. And every time they stop flying, they need to eat. And so they form these big groups wherever there's a lot of little insects in a local area to feed on. And that's why you're starting to get the swarms. And they do this pretty much every fall. They can do it throughout the year, but you see a lot more of them now than you would earlier in the year.
Well, you've also said that there might be a spike in the kind of insects that the dragonflies feed on, and maybe something related to hurricane flooding or rain.
Yeah, so the data that I've collected through my dragonfly swarm project suggests that disturbances play a really important role in this behavior, so that anytime you get fires or floods or big storms or even people mowing their lawns is enough to kind of kick up a bunch of little insects that the dragonflies will take advantage of.
More pointedly, do you think this is about climate change? We know there's been hurricane-related flooding. Do you think it's from the changing climate?
It's possible that climate change is related, but it's hard to say whether something's being impacted by climate change without a very large data set. Mm-hmm. I think it's too early to say, but with the recent hurricane that came through, it's likely that the increase of rain, any sort of localized flooding, increases the number of mosquitoes and other small insects, and the dragonflies are flying in, taking care of that while they're on the move southward.
Okay. You call yourself the dragonfly woman. What's the attraction for you of dragonflies?
For me, it's that they look so beautiful and delicate, but they're so impressive. I mean, they are amazing predators. They can eat all kinds of giant things. They've been known to eat birds, like hummingbirds. Some species have been documented catching and eating hummingbirds. And I just think anytime you get an insect that's big enough to turn the tides on birds, that's really pretty cool.
Yeah, or not. I mean, I'm thinking that if you're in one of these swarms, it's either like you're in the middle of a Disney movie like Snow White with little dragonflies all over you, or it's a horror. You know, it's a nightmare. What do you hope to learn? And just what's the best swarm you've ever seen?
I think the best swarm I've ever seen was the very first one that got me interested in this behavior in the first place. I was doing aquatic work in Arizona and was around a pond that didn't have any vegetation, so we really never saw dragonflies. But one day, my coworker and I showed up, and there were hundreds and hundreds of dragonflies there flying in a big swarm. And I got really excited about that, which is why I have my project in the first place. But I'm hoping to learn several different things. I want to know why or where the behavior forms in the first place, how that swarming pattern occurs, like what are they doing, why are they doing it, and how it benefits our environment.
That's Chris Goforth, head of citizen science at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. She runs a citizen science project called the Dragonfly Swarm Project. It's a thing. We'll link you up to everything at herenow.org. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, while Chris said some dragonflies can attack hummingbirds, we want to reassure you that swarms are not dangerous and dragonflies don't aim to bite people. The more you know.
120, we'll give 120, we'll give 130. 130, we'll give 130, we'll give 140.
It's called the auction chant, and Cookie Lockhart has been doing it for more than 50 years. When she started, female auctioneers were almost unheard of. Now she's an auctioneering legend far beyond her home of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Stina Sieg of Colorado Public Radio has our story.
Everyone knows Cookie Lockhart. That's what the first newspaper article about her said back when she was 5 and known for riding her horse through downtown Steamboat Springs. Growing up here, both her dad and brother were auctioneers, and eventually she followed them into the business.
People always say, well, what do you sell? And I say, well, bulls, buttons, buffalo, bulldozers, rabbits, rakes, ratchets, real estate, planes, trains, canes, I've sold it all.
At 81, she still does, often while wearing shiny gold outfits and big, jewel-encrusted glasses. It all began in her 20s, when she was a divorced mom to 2 young daughters and trying to figure out her next move.
My mother said, well, why don't you go to auction school? And I said, auction school, isn't that for boys?
Lockhart ended up the only woman in a class of more than 120. She was intimidated, but soon found that unmistakable chant came easily to her. In the mid-1960s, she proved it on television as a contestant on the game show To Tell the Truth. Lockhart got her chance on national TV early. But as the rare female auctioneer, she still had to scrap it out for decades. She says men would sometimes refuse to let her auction off their property, or male auctioneers wouldn't share a stage with her.
I feel like real secure men really accept me. But, you know, a lot of people have complexes.
Her skills were undeniable, though. In 2007, she became the first woman to be inducted into the National Auctioneers Association Hall of Fame. Last year, when she turned 80, she was too busy auctioneering to celebrate the occasion. So this year, she declared she was turning 80 again, with a big bash at a local restaurant. These singers are from Opera Steamboat, which is now working on a show about her life. Nancy McCormish looks up to Lockhart for breaking in to a man's industry.
Women weren't allowed to do that. It was impossible. Women could be a stewardess, a nurse, a secretary, or a wife. That was it. Period.
Other female auctioneers, like Janelle Karras, say Cookie Lockhart has done so much for women in the auction world.
When I started about 20 years ago, there were very few women. But we're growing in numbers now, so it's really great to see.
Lockhart looks in awe of the celebrations swirling around her.
I got to enjoy it all and get all those hugs and memories. Chance of a lifetime, right?
190, 190, we'll give 190, 190, we'll give 190, y'all done?
As a party highlight, Lockhart auctions off one of her signature jackets, a glittery gold number covered in sequins.
Sold it! Judy Monet, you're the buyer, $180. Thank you, Jude.
People ask Lockhart all the time when she's going to retire. But she says when you find your calling, you've got to use it. And she's not ready to get off the stage yet. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
For many people of religious faith, climate change has been elevated to a moral and existential crisis, and a growing number of churches are now taking an active role in the fight against it. Among the leaders in this effort is Reverend Michael Malcolm, founder and executive director of the People's Justice Council in Birmingham, Alabama. Reverend Malcolm also serves as the environmental justice representative for the Southeast Conference, a regional body of the United Church of Christ. Reverend Malcolm, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Reverend Malcolm, there's been this loose narrative out there that somehow there's a conflict between religion and science over the climate crisis, and your work challenges this idea. You teach that our role as humans is to act as stewards of the earth and the environment, and you call it sustainability and creation care. I'm really fascinated by how you approach this, not only through your activism, but through the pulpit, through the Word of God.
Yeah, so my approach and my theological understanding comes from that of the prophetic heritage. And in the prophetic heritage, there was no distinction. That is exactly what prophets did. They looked at what was happening in society and declared whether or not it was an abuse against the Creator and the creation. And I think that is our obligation as leaders of faith movements, as leaders of communities of faith. It's our obligation to be that spokesman or that watcher on the wall that declares what's going on to the society.
You're a coalition builder, and you are working with lots of other faith leaders to speak to these communities and to work with these communities in order to get these issues to the forefront and to the larger discourse around climate change. What are the big climate issues that you all feel as faith leaders that you need to work together to tackle?
Most of it is driven by a mentality of immorality, because it's greed that's driving this, and it's overconsumption that's driving this. And so what I often try to teach and preach and talk about at tables and in pulpits and wherever I get a platform, it is that we have to address the spiritual and the moral deficiencies that are causing this, which is the greed and the overconsumption. And that's where we land best. But not only addressing this, we have to plant a vision of hope that we can see past this. I can't recall the person that I heard it said from, but I heard it said that climate defeatism is just as bad as climate denialism. Mm. So we have to teach the people that we can still win, while at the same time saying the only way we do win is if we change our societal structures. And those societal mechanisms of control and oppression that cause us to be so divided, and we have to work together, and we've all got to get in this fight.
You have your feet in lots of places throughout the South and Southeast, including Alabama, where you're the founder of the People's Justice Council. What are some environmental injustices that you're seeing specifically there?
Yeah, so specifically in Alabama, we see we've got a coal ash issue that's happening now where what we're fighting against. We still have pollutant facilities. We are still one of the highest pollutant states in the Southeast. We've got various other environmental justice issues when it comes down to sewage, when it comes down to the landfills. But honestly, I would be remiss if I didn't say that Alabama is not uncommon to the Southeast. That's why I do what I do.
Do you find that folks in your congregation, that resonates with them, thinking about their behaviors, thinking about the day-to-day ways that they on an individual level and collectively can bring about change?
Absolutely. I have an older mother in my church. We use mother as an endearing term for our older saints in our church. And so Mother Rose McGuire, when I started talking about the environment and talking about climate change and start speaking about climate stewardship and creation care, and my messages start turning toward that, and she became one of my biggest champions. Mm-hmm. Because that has been something near and dear to her. And what she did and what I saw was she linked it back to her childhood and remembering how when she was growing up, she grew up and they had a garden and how they were growing their own food. And she remembered the good times around this garden. And so it began to tie back into her childhood, and the land tied into her childhood. And I saw in that, that there's something about us marrying ourselves back to the land that will cause us to have better relationships, period.
Hmm. And I can imagine from your view that also ties to your direct relationship with God.
Absolutely. Well, the way we treat the land and the way we treat people is our relationship with God. Look at society and the way it is now. We are consumers. We see everything as commodity. And we look at people as commodity. We look at land as commodity. We also look at our relationship with God as commodity. We treat God just like we treat the land, and that we just take, take, take. And it's never reciprocal where we ever giving.
Climate change is often politicized as a left versus right issue. And I'm wondering how you navigate this with your congregation and community members.
I'm a bit crass when it comes down to my reply to that, and that it doesn't matter whether you like it or not, whether where you sit politically or not, you're still affected by it. And there's something you can do not to be affected by it if you get involved. Who you vote on or who you vote for is entirely your business, but if you don't start seeing this land and our relationship with this land and our relationship with God tied to this relationship with the land and the people, it doesn't matter who you vote for.
Hmm. What's next in your fight to not make the Southeast othered and really to bring community together to fight this climate crisis?
I advocate at tables, and my feet is everywhere, and I'm everywhere, and the message is always the same. You have to allow communities to lead. You've got to listen to communities. Communities need to be at this table. And that will continue to be my message, and that will continue to be one of my biggest proponents of what I do with the People's Justice Council, because I really, really believe in the heart of hearts that environmental justice is the solution to the climate crisis that we face.
That's Reverend Michael Malcolm, founder and executive director of the People's Justice Council in Birmingham, Alabama. Reverend Malcolm also serves as the environmental justice representative for the Southeast Conference. Reverend Malcolm, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That conversation is part of Covering Climate Now, a global collaboration of more than 250 news outlets around the world. And this note, we'll also be covering the UN Climate Summit in New York next Monday, September 23rd. And ahead of that meeting, the young Swedish activist Greta Thunberg will be leading an international climate strike of kids and adults from at least 150 countries. In a speech at George Washington University, Thunberg urged youngsters to join the strikes on September 20th and 27th.
Activism works. So what I'm telling you to do now is to act. Because no one is too small to make a difference.
Thunberg will hold a rally in New York on Friday, and she'll be joined by hundreds of students from around the country, including many from New York's public schools. They've been given permission to join the rally. And public schools in other cities are also allowing students to demonstrate on Friday. Teachers are being asked to take the opportunity to make this a moment of education on climate issues for the kids. We'll have more on climate coverage this week on Here and Now.
One of the most recognizable voices of NPR over more than four decades has been stilled. Cokie Roberts died at 75. She was born into the beating heart of politics. Both of her parents served in Congress. She became a trailblazer in the then male-dominated field of political reporting.
The debate over equal rights is no longer in the realm of theory. The state after state rejects the federal Equal Rights Amendment.
That's Cokie reporting on the ERA in 1978, just after she joined NPR. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson is here. Mara, thank you so much. We know this is a tough day.
Yeah, this is a big one.
Yeah.
She was a giant.
Okay, we're going to keep going here. And we also have Madalika Sicca, executive producer of audio at The Washington Post. That's now, but executive producer of Morning Edition, executive editor of news at NPR. You also worked with Cokie at ABC. Madalika, our hearts to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's a really sad day.
Yeah, and Mara, this is so tough, but I thought we'd start with a smile, because Cokie, Nina Totenberg, Linda Wertheimer, Susan Stamberg, these are the founding mothers of NPR.
We used to call them the Fallopian Club.
Yes. I was hoping the Fallopian Club. I was hoping you'd say that. And how rare, just put that in context, how rare was that?
Well, at the time that they all came to NPR, it was unusual to have so many women in such prominent roles at a news organization. Now, some of that was because NPR was paid so poorly back then. And a lot of times when male reporters got to a certain age or got married, had kids, they would leave for a higher paying job at a television network. That's not true anymore. We're completely competitive for salary wise. But NPR was a real home for these women. And Cokie in particular was a giant. And I've said on Twitter today that she didn't just inspire younger female journalists like myself. And she, of course, did do that. But she directly, actively kind of intervened, threw her body in front of obstacles for me. I mean, I would not have the job I have today if it wasn't for her. She made it happen that I went to Congress to be her number two. So I worked under her on Capitol Hill. I got to observe her kind of stalking the halls of Congress where she grew up. And she taught me how to do what I do today.
Yeah. Well, we have her to thank.
Literally.
Yes. And Madalika, a mentor to you as well?
Absolutely. I was a young producer when I first met Cokie in the 90s, and network television was a very male-dominated place, and there was a woman who was substitute anchoring Nightline at the time. All our bosses were men, and she was a woman with stature who had our back. Mm-hmm. And it is something that she has had for all of us who knew her and even the people who didn't know her. I don't think a lot of women understand how much we owe to Cokie for paving the way, especially in this town.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of us watching from a commercial broadcast on the sidelines knew, because we didn't have, you know, there wasn't a lot of that. And it's hard to get at just how rare this was, this many women, you know, standing up like this, many women having these jobs. And Madalika, people have been asking what happened, and we know she had breast cancer. There were complications, but she lived with that breast cancer diagnosed for years. You wrote a book about your own experience, and how about she helped you with that?
Oh, she was the first person almost beyond my immediate family that actually not even my immediate family. Even before I talked to my father, I talked to her because I didn't know how to tell him. And she, of course, was the consummate journalist in giving me a list of the things I needed to ask and what I should be prepared for as I started going through the process, how to tell my daughters who were young at the time. She was my handholder. You know, I benefited from her knowledge and experience because, of course, she had gone through it. You know, she even told me the hairdresser to go to get my wig. You know, I mean, There are so many ways that she was incredibly supportive, both professionally and personally for me. And I have been just the wind was knocked out of me when I found out that she was gone.
Well, listeners, too, we're hearing from them. And Mara, just, you know, she was such a shepherd at NPR, but it seems in the city as well. I mean, George Will, who worked with her at ABC, is saying she was a custodian of the manners of this city.
I think there's no doubt about that. She upheld values and a kind of approach to journalism that I hope isn't dying out. But, you know, she was, you could say she was Democratic royalty. We don't use that word in the United States, but both her parents were members of Congress. Her father was the majority leader of the House of Representatives. Her brother and sister both ran for Congress. And she did uphold those manners. She used to joke that she was brought up to be prejudiced only against two groups of people, Republicans and senators. I think she was never really prejudiced against Republicans. She was really, I mean, I remember trailing behind her in the halls of the Capitol, and she knew every single tunnel and secret place because she grew up there. And she could fiercely question the Speaker of the House, and then 2 minutes later, she would be talking to one of the cafeteria workers who she'd known all her life.
Mara Liasson, Madalika Sika, thank you so much for helping us remember Cokie Roberts. We'll be doing it throughout the day. Thank you.
Thank you.